think it's really helpful.
All right, let's get started. Sorry, we're running out of seats here for everyone, but it should be a riveting talk anyway, in any case. So, Patricia, please take away.
Great. Well, my talk is going to be very different because I'm going to be pretending you are some of my medical students and graduate students that I have an opportunity to tell about some of the things that I think are really important in modern day science. I'm part of the Center for Immunity and Inflammation at Rutgers New Jersey Medical School, and my main research focus and my funded research from the NIH has been on HIV since really the very beginning of the HIV epidemic. But today I'm going to focus a little bit more on vaccines and then also how emerging pathogens, and in particular Zika, are affecting us. So we know that infectious disease has a major effect on human populations. And there's a couple of really, really cool books out there. This one by Jared Diamond, Tuck, Guns, Germs, and Steel, which was a New York Times bestseller, a Pulitzer Prize winner. It talks about how infectious diseases have really focused society and has changed society. Likewise, Plagues and Peoples by William McNeill is another interesting book to read about history. So, whoops, I'm going the wrong way. How do I make this go forward? I'm pushing the right one. The left one went backwards. Okay. So, and I'll make a statement that I think that most here, being scientists, would agree with, but that vaccines and antibiotics were among the greatest medical triumphs of the 20th century. And new approaches, vaccines are being developed at breathtaking speed in this century. So I don't think I have to convince you that vaccines are a good thing, but you're probably aware of those in your neighborhoods, in your churches, who look skeptically at vaccines. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of information on that to start. So in the course of a normal immune response, and I'm an immunologist, we get, upon first infection, we get an initial response, which is mediated by antibodies and effector T cells. And that goes up, you get clearance of the disease, and then the response will go down. The cells that you don't need anymore are going to die by apoptosis. So let's say this was a flu infection. Even within the same flu season, you may have an apparent reinfection, but you've still got cells that are, and mediators such as antibodies floating around and T cells that are going to be able to deal with that very, very quickly. So the second time that you encounter that flu during the same flu season, you're not even going to be necessarily aware that you've gotten it. But the real beauty of the immune system is the establishment of long-term memory. And in this case, they're showing a couple years later that you get exposed to the same organism, you get a very fast and very high peak of immune activity through these antibodies and T cells, and you might feel a little sick, but you probably won't, and you'll be protected. And so often, if you feel like you're coming down with a cold, it probably you are, in that you've got memory that's kicking in and stopping it in its tracks before you have a chance to actually get that infection to be fully blown. So you're not being a hypochondriac. You probably are kicking into your immune system. And we now know that this can last a lifetime, so that when they went back and looked at people who were vaccinated for smallpox, even 30, 40 years earlier, still had immunological memory enough to be boosted and would probably be adequate to be protected. So literally, immunity can last a lifetime. So another important concept in vaccinology is that of herd immunity. And that is that if nobody is immunized against a disease, and you have a few index cases shown here in red, the blue are healthy but not immunized, then if it's a disease that passes quickly, something like measles, for example, you're going to get everybody infected. If you get a few people in the population that get immunized, then the contagious disease is going to be somewhat limited by contacts, but you still have many susceptible people. So you're still going to get the majority of individuals who are going to be are going to be infected, and that yet your people who are immunized are going to be protected. And then here, if most of the population gets immunized, then you get less of a chance of spreading person to person, and the spread of the contagious disease is contained. And the level of herd immunity depends upon how infectious is the organism. For example, flu has a pretty short replication time, a very short prodrome, but compared to measles, you have more time and less of a requirement for immunization to get herd immunity. Measles, because it passes so rapidly and so dramatically, you need to have almost your whole population to be immunized before that's going to be effective. So that's something that epidemiologists have to consider in vaccine strategies. So this is a child with a disease that hopefully you will never, ever see in your lifetime. And this is smallpox. So this is one of the last recorded cases of smallpox, and you can see that this child, if he survives, and hopefully he did, is going to have a lot of the characteristic pocking that was typical of someone who survived smallpox. So this was one of our biggest triumphs, in that the smallpox vaccine was introduced around the late 1960s. We see that the number of cases were just dropped super dramatically, actually going back a little bit further, even the number of cases precipitously dropped. So those in my generation will have your typical smallpox scar, but most of the young people in the room have not ever been immunized and have no need to. And that's because we were able by establishing a vaccination rate that led to the herd immunity, able to eliminate smallpox from the world. So this World Health Organization in 1979 declared that smallpox was officially eradicated. So that changed our vaccine strategy so that people don't need to be immunized anymore. However, if it were, heaven forbid, become a bioterrorist weapon, then we do have built up stocks of vaccine to be able to quickly get us back to this position. So this smallpox wasn't our only triumph. These are the years that the vaccines were introduced. So rubella cases have dropped dramatically. Paralytic polio in the developed world at least has dropped to zero cases. Pertussis, we're still having it, and there's been some resurgence, but this is a log scale, so this is a very significant drop. Mumps, measles, and diphtheria. So these are some real triumphs of 20th century vaccinology. So now, if we look at what the vaccination schedule looks like for children, I don't intend you to be able to read this, but this is going from birth all the way up to ages 16 to 18, and this is the recommended vaccines. And it's quite dramatic, the number of vaccines. Today's vaccines are safer. There's less whole organisms, a lot less antigens, and a lot of protection. My daughter just sent me a picture of the sheet that her son just received. He's 2 months old. He received his vaccination, and there were three or four like rotavirus, pneumococcal, the acellular pertussis that are completely different than when she was a child. So it's a really growing field. However, even though we have effective vaccines, there are many diseases that we don't have vaccines for that still kill a lot of people. Malaria worldwide kills almost 1 million people. Schistosomiasis, worm infestations, tuberculosis, 1.5 million. The existing vaccine is not very effective, and we don't use it in the U.S. Diarrhea diseases, respiratory infections, HIV/AIDS as of 2012 was still killing about 2 million a year. And despite billions of dollars, we still don't have an effective HIV vaccine. And measles, even though we have a good vaccine, the problem is getting it to people. And because of that requirement of huge amount of herd to be covered to get immunity, we're still seeing worldwide almost 500,000 deaths. So another problem, though, that's approaching us is that there's a global trend of emerging infectious diseases. And this was looked at a study from 1940 to 2004. that there were 335 infectious diseases that emerged that were completely unknown or unconsidered prior to that. So this is going to be a huge problem in terms of as some of these become global or pandemic. So pandemic is not meaning that it's something's particularly lethal, but it means that it reaches a certain level of around the world infection. So the definition of an emerging infectious disease is something whose incidence has increased in the last two decades or threatens to increase, and they're either emerging or re-emerging. So it could be new infections that result from changes or evolution of existing organisms, geographical spread of known infections, so Zika would be one of those, previously unrecognized infection appearing in areas undergoing ecological transformation. I think Lyme disease falls into that. Old infections emerging as a result of antimicrobial resistance. So we now have, for example, drug-resistant tuberculosis, which is causing big problems. And it's estimated that emerging infectious diseases account for about 12% of human pathogens. So this is another busy slide that I borrowed from Tony Fauci, who's the head of the NIAID. But it shows you some of the geographical locations of the emerging, some of these emerging diseases. And so you're going to, and this was before Zika, so I don't even think Zika comes onto this, but you see things like H5N1 flu, SARS, et cetera, that we think about. But there's really tons of these. And as human civilization expands, even in places like, or especially in places like Africa, then things are emerging that were kept apart from human populations. So since my lab studies HIV/AIDS and has done so for the beginning, I'll use it as an example. So the first major emergence was in 1980 and 81 in the U.S., and it rapidly became pandemic, probably mostly because of our ability to travel so readily throughout the world. It infects cells of the immune system, so it causes a systemic immunodeficiency. So that's particularly insidious. It kills the very T cells, the dendritic cells that we need to fight it. It's now recognized, however, as also being a chronic infection that causes an immune activation syndrome, so that we see chronic immune activation that leads to a lot of the sequelae that are coming up now that people are living longer. As of 2014, it was estimated that 36.9 million people are living with HIV infection, and that a similar number of people have died. And there's still, despite massive decreases because of various public health policies, approximately 2 million new cases are developing a year. And in our own HIV center, we're seeing about 150 to 200 new cases per year. Originally, HIV was a death sentence when I first started studying it, but now with effective antiretroviral therapy, individuals are living longer. And importantly, perinatal transmission has been essentially eliminated from the Western world. So all mothers are screened, and even if you only catch it at the time that she comes in to deliver by giving antiretroviral therapy to the mom and the child and to do a cesarean birth, you're able to prevent transmission of the virus. So, and this has gotten a lot of attention recently, that now we have a new problem that increases in life expectancy among treated HIV positive individuals means that a 20-year-old individual infected with HIV who is on effective antiretroviral therapy in the developing world or developed world, US and Canada, can now be expected to live until their early 70s, which is approaching life expectancy of the general population. And my lab is currently studying HIV in the context of aging. All right, I think I have to hurry up. Okay, so Zika virus is another important, probably the pathogen du jour. So the first report of this was in 2013, didn't get much attention, but there were birth defects in French Polynesia but didn't get much attention. October 2015, there was a major outbreak in Brazil and reports of microcephaly. And it's now found in more than 48 countries or territories as of June 2016. There's multiple cases in U.S. from travelers to these areas, over 1,000 now, but not. There hasn't been a lot about transmission locally, transmitted primarily by urban mosquitoes. But there's now evidence for sexual transmission. That's absolutely been proven. So somebody who's infected can pass it on, and it can even stay in semen for months. And possible person-to-person transmission has been recently reported in Colorado and Florida. So those are just in the last couple of weeks. You may have heard of those studies. So the Zika virus is a single-stranded RNA virus from the flaviviridae. It's closely related to dengue fever, yellow fever, Japanese encephalitis, and West Nile viruses. So you probably have heard of some of these as also being important emerging pathogens. And it's primarily through the bite of this mosquito, but can also be transmitted by this mosquito, although the Aedes albopticus prefers to bite animals than people, so it's less important. So these are the areas where the epidemic is really very strong, so all of these South American countries, Central America and Mexico, and we're starting perhaps to see some in the very south of America, of the U.S. So Zika virus, of course, is particularly devastating because it can cause virus-induced fetal abnormalities. So this is your typical, what's being seen is that individuals, babies born to Zika-infected moms, especially infected during the first and second trimester, you can get microcephaly, which can be either minor or severe. It can also cause miscarriage and other brain abnormalities. And it's now been proven in a mouse model where you get the exact same thing, where you get microcephaly, placental damage, and fetal demise in mice. It can also cause Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is an autoimmune disease in adults, where the immune system attacks the nerve cells, which can cause weakness and paralysis. So to go quickly here, can Zika be transmitted in the U.S.? The answer would be yes, it can potentially, even through mosquitoes. And certainly we know that there's confirmed sexual transmission and survival in semen. And intriguingly, a single amino acid change can dramatically increase the host mosquito range. And there's now been a report out of Brazil that mosquitoes in Brazil, house mosquitoes, the common house mosquitoes, some of them are carrying the virus. So there's also... So, and this is the estimated range of the Aedes aegypti mosquito. So you can see that I'm from New Jersey. You can get all the way up through New York, Southern California, all these areas. So these mosquitoes are present here. And then if you look at the second species, it's even a broader range, the albopticus. So it's a big concern. So the Christian response to emerging infectious diseases. I liked this verse from Micah 6:8. He has shown you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To ask justly, act justly, and love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. So how do we, as a Christian community and as a society, live out that? So I think the first thing that we have to do is, one of the ways that we can act as scientists justly is through science advocacy. So HIV through effective lobbying, both from affected communities, so this is the gay community, as well as the scientific community, led to money for research and development of a huge infrastructure for rapid testing of therapies and health policies. In the case of Zika, we've been trapped a bit in our impasse in Congress, where they got into big fights about whether or not to release money. Not everyone agreed that we should release money for Zika virus and mosquito prevention, but Congress ended up going on a 7-week recess with no money released to fight mosquitoes. So it's a big problem. Christians, and particularly scientists who are Christians, need to advocate for effective science and public health infrastructure for dealing with not just Zika, but other emerging infectious diseases. And we need to be the voices in our communities and our churches that advocates for science as being something that is good and can solve problems and not. And Christians also have the opportunity through giving and through sending to respond to global needs. Infectious diseases do not respect borders or peoples. We can't build any walls that are going to keep them out. So humanitarian efforts are important too, and I'll end here. On the ground, missionary, non-government organizations, and local medical groups, as well as government groups, have been instrumental in the HIV and Ebola crises. And we need to keep supporting these people who go to these countries and train locals to treat. And there are individual heroes like Dr. Stella Ameyo Adadeva, who is a descendant of one of the earliest Nigerian converts. And she has been credited with keeping Ebola out of Nigeria. She recognized that a patient that was admitted to her hospital had Ebola. And by containing that individual, not letting him leave, not managed to keep it very, very much contained. Unfortunately, in the process, she and a few of her nurses caught Ebola and died. Mm-hmm. But that kind of a loving response and using her scientific knowledge to really stop it has led Nigeria to be declared free of Ebola. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to stop there and happy to take any questions. Has it decreased?
Has it increased?
No, it's actually decreased. So it leveled off and is now decreasing. So the number of new cases because of public health programs are decreasing. But there are pockets. Like I work in Newark, New Jersey, and there are areas in Newark that the HIV incidence is as high as anywhere in sub-Saharan Africa. And so there are attempts to go out into the community for education and giving prophylactic antiretroviral therapies, et cetera. So
do you have an estimate of what percent of the U.S. population is HIV positive?
Oh, it's very small. I think there's only 2 million people living with HIV in the U.S. at this point, so it's, you know, certainly less than 1%, maybe 0.5%. I don't know the exact number, but the new cases are decreasing.
Questions? Is there anything to the word I've heard that with antiretroviral availability and a long life expectancy that people are taking a casual attitude toward HIV and therefore reversing healthy public health preventive methods?
Yes, and where there is an uptick again is in young gay men who are seeming to take more risks and be less concerned about it. So that there is some truth there, absolutely. Yeah.
Along the same lines, have you noticed a decrease in funding for NIH for HIV research, for basic science research?
No, not really, and we still have an expedited cycle that was started years ago. So my grants get reviewed a little bit faster than average grants by a month or two. There's still good levels of funding, but obviously there's only a certain pie that's being cut up in different ways. And for example, for Zika virus research, they're actually taking some money in the absence of any action on Congress's part, which I think is just ethically horrible. They're taking money out of Ebola and putting it there, since Ebola seems to be calming down a little bit. But there's still a huge effort. We have an AIDS clinical trials unit and a Center for AIDS Research. I think there's still a lot of money for HIV research. And what we've learned in HIV has dramatically increased our knowledge of immunology, so to help other infectious disease research. So things, it's sort of like the space research. It's not just about esoteric, you know, let's go to Mars, but it's taught us so much science and technology. There was a question? Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering if you have a sense of to what extent changing geographies of disease vectors is being impacted by climate change. That's a big factor in the spread and emergence of new diseases.
Sure. So as the world is getting warmer, we're seeing a lot fewer destruction of organisms like mosquito larvae, et cetera, over summer. So that's over winter so that you have a bigger bloom coming in the spring. So I think that that's absolutely taking effect. Man made changes on, you know, taking out rainforests, et cetera, are pushing some animals that would normally be secluded from people into human environments. And so that's why you're getting some of these as well. So yeah, absolutely, ecological changes, both the climate change and just how what we're doing to our environment in general are making big effects. Terry?
Obviously, when we talk about disease, we're talking about a very human-centric approach to all of these things. I just wonder, you know, just out of curiosity, if you or, you know, any Christian who's interested in, say, extinction, if you've thought about the quasi-extinction of smallpox,
yeah,
or other, you know, viruses and pathogenic microbes that, you know, we're happy to eliminate,
but you're wondering
for the sake
if it...
of human well-being. But, you know, what, how do you think about that as a sort of a steward of creation? Are, you know, is smallpox just, you know, intrinsically bad? And it's okay to get rid of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is, and I think it's okay. And unfortunately, extinctions are occurring, I think they say, 100 species or hundreds of species every day. So, you know, is there a possibility of causing massive destruction of things that might be helpful? And I think that the whole idea of the microbiome is, you know, we absolutely need our microbiome in order to protect us. Those commensal organisms protect us from pathogenic organisms. So we've wreaked havoc through overuse of antibiotics in animal feed, et cetera. So I think in terms of stewardship, there's a very bad example. But does knocking out a virus here or there that just kills people, unless you think population control through viruses is a good thing, then I think, which, you know, that there are some advantages perhaps, so you could argue, but in general, no.
Any more questions?
Okay.
Just to kind of extend on that, then, beyond just approaching or trying to combat the pathogen itself, what about vector-borne pathogens and approaches that want to limit or even reduce the population of the vector, which is now kind of this, you know, bystander in this whole situation? How do you comment on that? Yeah, example, mosquitoes, the Zika, malaria.
Yeah. I mean, is there any potential negative about destroying all of the mosquitoes? I don't know, but certainly that's one of the goals of what people are trying to do right now, is to keep down the numbers of these mosquitoes. And if it does make this jump to the common house mosquito, we're toast. I mean, so we've got to get a vaccine. There is a new dengue vaccine, and so hopefully the same principles can be applied to that in developing this, a vaccine for Zika.
Gentlemen in back there.
The natural host for, like, malaria is mammals, humans, and so I think rather than attack on mosquitoes, I think we need to improve the global economy so that you don't have people living in homes that are accessible to mosquitoes. So you think of the mosquitoes, there's plenty of mosquitoes in the U.S., we have no malaria, very little dengue, you know, and Zika a little bit, but it's because we don't sleep in a place where we can be bitten by mosquito. So I'd like to make a case for environmental stewardship, but also just sort of social justice to do more to develop, rather than using only a vaccination or a medical model, to say how do we reduce poverty globally so that people don't sleep in places where they can be bitten by mosquitoes. And then we can also have mosquitoes to provide food for barn swallows and stuff like that.
Okay. Or yeah, that's an interesting. No, you've got a good point. So one of the reasons in the U.S. that we're not as going to be as susceptible is mosquitoes can't really survive in air conditioning because they get desiccated very quickly. So I don't know how you do that globally. I don't think you can. But your point is very well taken.
The gal here, and then in the back here.
Could I just clarify? I heard you correctly when you said the mother to child transmission of the HIV AIDS virus has virtually been eliminated?
In the developed world, and it's much better now in the developing world. So, yeah, you see virtually no, unless there's someone sneaks by.
That's what
So, you really see very little of it. And I had a study where I was looking at mother-child pairs where there were six, this was maybe 15 years ago, 60, we studied 67 kids in a row, and there were only two infections. That was right after the first antiretroviral therapy, whereas before it was one in three were getting disease. So.
Yes, I was involved with the HIV-AIDS clinical trial grassroots study in South Africa, 2001 to 2002. And facing a lot of resistance or whatever. I think they made great strides there in Africa,
right.
But I don't, and in Kenya, then in 2009.
Right. No, but it's not eliminated. No, but in the U.S. and in Europe, you don't really
yes.
see it.
Gotcha.
There's another.
Excuse me, the last question here.
Yeah, just curious to know if you have information. We focus on human beings, but is there like a matching emergence on other species? And, you know, I'm just wondering if there's an implication of human behavior, race, and emergence. I don't know if you have it.
Yeah, I don't have data on that, but I think that there must be, and certainly there are things that are popping up in dogs and domestic dogs and cats that either we didn't know about, like feline leukemia virus, which is related to HIV, and some of these canine flus that, you know, because they will cross species. So there must be. I don't think there's nearly as much attention being paid to this, of course. But yeah, but it makes sense. I mean, biologically, it makes a lot of sense. So.
All right, let's thank Patricia.